11, and then we would have run off with the others. So move on to before the agenda is adopted to amend it. We'll be finishing at 11:30 at the very latest 12 o'clock. Thank you. We have someone to propose adoption. Thank you, Honourable Williams. Seconded by Honourable Quirinoff. Great. Input. Well, as I said, we welcome your presence here, DDG Ammonia. We have a gambling bill on the table, the remote... Am I using the proper title for that bill? The remote gambling bill, is that correct? Just looking at the proponent here. Oh, is that right? Yes. Gosh, I just missed you. Got back from Russia in one piece. Well done. Okay. Yes, and it must have been well looked after by the Bushkas, eh? Here we are. Can we turn over to yourself, DVD?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think we are at your mercy, because I think when we got the invite, we were trying to figure out why are we here. And so we don't really have a presentation. But perhaps just to provide the context, I think, obviously, Cheney is not responsible. Well, let me say something. I've got Mr. Thomas Heck, as you said. I don't know. He's part of the furniture, and I'm not. And as you said, I've got an input from the MIC as well, so from the to support the entities and so on that you brought to the Minister of Finance. And, you know, we can come back and do something and provide any favor should you need any. But I'll just provide the context. I think that as far as Treasury is concerned, obviously the gambling policy is led by the Department of Trade and Industry, and we would therefore defer to the Department to determine the policy. We have, of course, been asked to come in at various points in the last few years, certainly starting with the National Gambling Amendments that were done in 2007, that's tabled, and it was passed by Parliament. We were required to do an interactive gambling bill, which really dealt with some of the tax issues and so on, because it required a money bill. And that bill was published for comment. And then at some point, I think the policy was in doubt, we sort of held back. And certainly I know this committee went through a process and a paper that GGI had produced, and that was one of the things. Then in 2011, our former Minister of Finance announced a gambling tax, which is something that we also still have in mind. We do intend to continue with it, but obviously, let me say that some of these bills weren't at the highest priority. And certainly, when it comes to the issue of gambling, I think it's a form of sin tax in a sense of, like we have a tax on tobacco. It's meant to be part of a package of measures to try and dissuade people from indulging too much in gambling. Okay, a little bit may be okay, but not too much, and certainly not to the point where people become indebted. So if you look at, like with tobacco, the excise that we have, it's meant to be to work with other measures. I think if you look at the tobacco industry, putting the extra excise on cigarettes, for example, is not by itself going to stop people from smoking. Yes, price is a factor, but you need a set of complementary measures. So saying that you can't smoke in this building, you've got to go outside, and educating people on the dangers of passive smoking, all of those are needed, I think, as part of a package to try and bring down sort of people smoking. In fact, not even too much. I think they shouldn't smoke at all if they're interested in their health. And I think the same that goes with the gambling industry, that the tax was meant to dissuade people, but to be effective, it's part to be part of a set of measures which the DGI was leading on. And of course, the other complexity that we have in this situation was, given that it's a concurrent function, and the whole issue of revenue. Certainly in the early 90s was a big issue. Provinces, many provinces saw this as manna from heaven, they're going to make a lot of money. Hence you had perhaps a pretty liberal regime. But you know, you can only gamble so much, and in fact I'm not sure you want people to gamble so much that they become over indebted. So certainly from a treasury, although I can't say there's a kind of developed policy framework, but my sense is we'll see the dangers of excessive gambling, and certainly see the need to limit that in some way. Now, whether the best way is to prohibit, or whether the best way is to regulate, I think we are open to either positions. Of course, it gets to almost like with marijuana. You know, is it best to regulate it, or is it best to drive it, make it illegal? And then one needs to take into account one's enforcement capacity. So if you take the whole area of remote gambling in particular, I think from a, although we don't have a policy, but you know, I guess our approach would be, can you really, you know, do you want to ban it completely? And if you ban it, then make sure that we have the enforcement capacity to prevent that. Or do you regulate it? And even if you regulate it, there are still weaknesses, because there are those who don't register. How do you deal with them, particularly if they're not based in South Africa? So I think these are the sorts of dilemmas that we have in place. To the extent that it's banned, for example, the issue of tax wouldn't arise. Then the issue is, I guess all the proceeds should come in some way to the state, to the extent that there are proceeds. To the extent that you regulate it, we would obviously apply the test that we have in mind, and certainly apply to that. Now, the other agency that does get involved is the South African Reserve Bank, which certainly is able to do some things in a sense of allowing you, people who gamble, to pay over. People may use their credit cards, etc., to gamble, or their accounts for funds. Certainly the Reserve Bank would be able to provide some information, but I should add, even there would be limits, because not everyone who's a gambling institution calls themselves a gambling institution, and therefore it's easy to identify. It may be a legitimate operation in another country, maybe a leisure company. So you don't also, the SARB would certainly have difficulty, the way I understand it, in applying any mechanism to prevent payment totally. So, you know, these are some of the challenges that we face. Having said that, in France, we can certainly provide more details. There's also just a general issue of the whole area of digital commerce. Certainly, it's one of the areas that has been looked at by the OECD. It's been looked at, if you look at the Davis Tax Committee, it does have a set of action points that is flagged around the digital economy. We introduced random digital services provided to South Africa. So many overseas establishments like Amazon.com, etc., now have to charge VAT, and there's a system for paying that over. Of course, the big ones may register. The point is, the small ones register, and they don't register. How do you deal with it? So we can certainly talk about the area of digital commerce just generally, because interactive or remote gambling would certainly often fall within that arena as well. So I guess that's the first set of issues for us, whether to ban or to limit or to regulate. And as far as I think we concern this as Treasury, as SARS, as FIC, as the SARB, we could certainly provide the mechanisms either way, and there are challenges in either approach, but it's something we leave to the DCI to lead on this. Currently, though, I'm not aware that there's any legislation to specifically, the way I understand it, to ban remote gambling. There is a National Gambling Act. It may have the provisions. I'm just stating my own ignorance here. Perhaps, but it's the National Gambling Act that we go by. and that's what we were meant to provide the interactive bill that I spoke about earlier, which we did publish for comment in 2008. I think the second set of issues relate to taxation and some of the practicalities, and France will talk about that. Related to that, of course, is the issue of revenue that comes in, and if you look at this bill, it can't, in our view, really deal with some of the revenue issues. Part of it would possibly be a money bill, or it could be a division of revenue sort of issue. The Constitution does require a particular approach, so one needs to check the current bill to see that it doesn't transgress those constitutional obligations. And the third set relates to money laundering. The gambling industry is one of the vulnerable areas where money laundering takes place, where people come in and legitimize their funds. As you know, South Africa is a member of FATF, which is a multilateral body that takes responsibility for coordinating actions against money laundering. We are under very strong commitments there to implement the measures agreed to, because to the extent that you have any weaknesses in the system, it does open up our financial institutions at the very least to actions by the regulators. You would have seen, for example, that the UK authorities imposed a fine on one of our banks for not meeting certain standards that was done last year. And of course, where you don't want to get to is, if you look at the US authorities, they've acted against banks like BNP Paribas, where the fines have been massive, okay, almost out of $10 billion or $9 billion. So it's in our own interest to make sure that our regulators are tough on those provisions. Now, I think a lot of the issues in this bill don't, on the one hand, I think don't deal with those adequately, and to the extent that they've been dealt with, we would say should be dealt with through the FIC Act. And there are amendments currently that have been published, which we intend to take to Parliament later this year, which can deal with some of those provisions. But for example, both on taxation and on money laundering, if a provider doesn't have some skin in South Africa, if their infrastructure is not in South Africa, or if they're not registered within South Africa, it almost becomes impossible to really get the required tax or take action. So there's a sort of know-your-customer approach that you have with money laundering provisions. Now, I can go through those, if you like, in a bit of detail, but let me stop here and see if France wants to just say some things related to some of the tax issues.
Thanks, Mona. Thank you, Chair. In the tax space, you have two sets of issues. You have the, let's call them the normal tax issues, which would be the income tax, the VAT, all of those taxes we're familiar with, and then you would have gambling-specific taxes. So just starting with the normal taxes, the two that would immediately come to mind would be income tax and VAT. And so for income tax, I mean, locally based operators would be taxed, as anybody else is. When we start talking foreign, it becomes a little bit more difficult because they will not have what is known in the tax speak as a permanent establishment in South Africa. In other words, they don't have a physical presence here, and that makes normal taxation very difficult. If you have a double taxation agreement in place with their home jurisdiction, because essentially what a double taxation agreement says, if there is no permanent establishment in what is known as the source jurisdiction, being South Africa, then the residence jurisdiction, being the home jurisdiction, gets to tax everything. Now that's an issue that is clearly of great interest currently internationally because of the shift to digital. The OECD has done a fair amount of work there, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, but it remains a thorny question. And I must say, having just read this bill, one of the things that did come to my mind was that unlike the National Gambling Amendment Act back in 2008, there is no specific requirement that the gambling equipment be based here. You can perhaps read it in, but as a competent attorney, I think could easily read it another way, that you need to have a place of business in South Africa, but the gambling equipment doesn't necessarily have to be here. As soon as that dichotomy takes place, you get into some very thorny tax questions of where you attribute the profit. So that would just be a point I make in passing. But when it comes to VAT, obviously locally based, you are required to levy VAT. When we are dealing with offshore, as of 2014, you are required to levy VAT as well when you are dealing with consumers. Continuing, we have three offshore gambling providers that we are aware of that have registered. The amounts they have paid over have been absolutely minimal, and I mean minimal, very small indeed. So the mechanism is there. To the extent you can enforce it, it does again become difficult if you don't have a presence in South Africa. You're then reliant on mutual assistance agreements as part of your double taxation agreement. Those are not all treaties include mutual assistance, and you don't have treaties with everyone. So you again run into issues. Talking to then the specific gambling taxes, I would just note that if you go back to the interactive gambling tax that Momo mentioned a bit earlier, SARS was not involved in administering that. That was going to be the main of the National Gambling Board, because they would have greater insight into the day-to-day operations than we would have had. Obviously, that is something that is open, the role that SARS would have in any future gambling tax that was specifically aimed at interactive or remote gambling. We are, of course, South Africa's primary revenue collection agency, so the Treasury likes us to collect everything that we can, but sometimes it does make sense to locate it somewhere else. And then, of course, we have the sort of overall gambling tax that is coming into force at some point, and that SARS would be looking at as the administrator, again, because in this case it's a national that cuts across all kinds of gambling. So SARS would be required to administer that one. That's just a little bit of background on the tax rate.
Perhaps I'll stop. I mean, but again, I think like Ron has outlined, we can go to specific issues, if you like, that from the privacy perspective, there's a problem. I think the fact, for example, that there's no identification requirements contained in the Act, there's no verification mechanisms, it seems the bill appears to allow the player to transact without being identified and verified up to the point of payout. Current players are, you know, some, as I said, almost impossible to identify them. There are a lot of edges like those that just expose, as I said, our entire financial system to weaknesses, which in terms of the standards we have to meet. And certainly we do intend to act even currently on gambling institutions, because I don't believe that our standards are high enough. They need to be tightened. And I think the bill would actually weaken the provisions, and as Francis pointed out, because they weaken it relative to the National Gambling Act provisions that are there currently. Thank you, Chair.
DDG, Mr. Moniant, just before I ask the members to come in with a question, there's just one or two things. You may have pointed it out, and perhaps I didn't hear you. The issue, you pointed out to us here that you took your reference point as the current national gambling legislation as it exists. And within that, as you know, there was some talk of the what they call the interactive gambling amendment or something, which in fact never took place, that was going to be incorporated into regulation, because as far as I recall, secondary legislation. But since then, there has been a huge study, a commission on gambling. But what I was not aware of and what you raised this morning was the issue about machinery. And I'm really asking those who were in the gambling before or were in the previous term, I suppose that's yourself, Honourable Little Lewis, you were here in the previous term. I don't think anyone else was, apart from staff, our researcher and content specialist. But I don't recall that specifying that machinery would be held in our own country, that is. But if, let us leave that aside. Are you aware of where this is the case, as SARS and as Treasury? You know, or just off the cuff, are you aware of other countries
where you are obliged through legislation to retain the gambling, if I would call it, equipment or machinery within the jurisdiction in which you are operating.
Chair, I must admit this is not an area I've studied deeply, but the National Gambling Amendment Act of 2008 amended Clause 737, in Clause 24 of Section 34, since that was an act that was passed, amended Section 37 of the Principal Act and inserted a subsection 4 which said it is a condition of every license to make interactive games available to play, but the interactive gambling equipment used by the interactive provider must be situated within the Republic. So that amendment was pretty clear that it had to be based here. I think that, certainly from a tax perspective, helps solve one of the problems we would face. If you look at the current bill, it's very clear that there needs to be a business establishment in South Africa. But one of the other clauses of the bill implies that it could be a business establishment and a set of premises where the equipment is held. So, well, the one leg is clear, the other leg is not, and that would, as I say, I think, create space for a innovative attorney, and working as far as we come across any of those, to make the argument that, well, there needs to be a business establishment in the country, but the equipment can be somewhere else.
All right. Now, that certainly refreshed my recollection. Thank you very much.
Yes, can I add, I mean, there's, obviously, when you look at the area of remote gambling, there's those that are conducted from a business within South Africa. Even if you don't like it, if there's an outside establishment, I mean, there's lottos, there's all kinds of things that are outside, they have no infrastructure, no connection. I don't know how we prevent that. And, I mean, when we were doing the interactive bill, those are precisely the kinds of questions we asked. So, for example, you know, do we then need to develop our own infrastructure where people are doing mystery shopping, mystery gambling, to go into these sites, and do we have the mechanisms in the SARB then to prevent payments through credit cards, but what if people pay through PayPal or through other, I mean, it's a little bit, I'm just saying, it's a difficult area that we need to be able to deal with.
Well, it certainly is. I mean, what is, there would get to be a difference between remote and interactive, given the current law. But let us move across to honourable members. I saw your own hand first, Honourable Hill Lewis, followed by the Honourable Williams, looking around Honourable Bernoff at this particular point. And just for that, we're quite clear. We've got his time. It calls it 4 minutes maximum. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Chairperson and presenters. Let me just make a couple of points. The rules for the introduction of a private medical and the legal advice that I received was suggested that I should consult National Treasury in the draft of the bill before the table. So I just want to put on record that I did write to the Minister's office on three separate occasions before tabling the legislation to ask for his comments on the bill or the comments of the National Treasury, and unfortunately never received a response to any of those letters. So, you know, some of the comments that you made today I find very helpful, and I would have been very happy to include them in the bill had I received them when I asked for the comments at the time. So that's the first thing. The second thing is the comments that you make about locating the physical infrastructure, machinery, etc. in the country, I take to heart. The intention of my bill is very much that all of the infrastructure, office, machinery, whatever you want to call it, is located in South Africa and that tax is paid in South Africa. And so if you could suggest wording from other legislation which makes that absolutely watertight, then I would very much be willing to defer to your expertise to ensure that that does happen. That's the second point. The third point is that the reason for calling you or asking you to present to us today, ideally I would have loved to have had the SOG, and I think it's very important to hear from them because the DCI has often made the case over the course of the last few weeks in discussing this bill and their policy that they are going to rely very heavily on the SARB and indirectly on you as well to enforce the policy and to be kind of peace behind the prohibition. And so, I wanted to hear a little bit more from Saab as to their capacity and track record in terms of actually doing that. But since Saab is not here, let me simply ask you this. The status quo is that the online gambling beyond that which is licensed is already illegal. It is already prohibited. And so I wonder whether you could sketch out for us, to the extent that you're aware, what the track record is in terms of enforcing that prohibition. What has been the consultation between you and the Department of Trade and Industry, you as in Treasury, not you personally, between Treasury and the DTI in the development of this new policy? Because as I said, the policy relies very heavily on Treasury and Saab to actually do enforcement. So what was the consultation that took place in developing this policy between Treasury and DTI? And are you confident that you have the capacity and the plans in place to be able to enforce such a prohibition in the future? And if you are confident, could you outline some of that capacity and plans beyond simply saying that you are able, as you said in your presentation, but can you sketch out some of the details to how that's actually going to be possible? Thank you.
I have to say one thing. On the last, you were referring to draft policy, which is flat for comment. So rather than the bill, which you have tabled here in Parliament, and I'll stick to that because, as we've already indicated, it's going to be something like an extension of 30 days or more, or 45 on that policy. That is why we said we'll come back and do the policy, because on hold for a short while. Honourable Williams?
Thanks, Chair. I just want to talk to two points. You said that there were three registered gambling providers that had registered with you and they were paying a small amount of money. I'd like to know, how did you register these companies if it's illegal? Are you registering illegal companies? They can pay you, so they've still gotten gain there. The next question is, how would, if this remote gambling bill were passed, how would you enforce that they stay local? Is there any mechanism that we could put in place that would make them stay local? For instance, they could register today and say, yes, their offices are in Sanson and whatnot, but then tomorrow, after they've got their license, they could just close up and move to OCs. Is there any mechanism to stop that from happening if it was legalized? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable
Williams. Honourable Cornwall. Thank you, Chairperson. There was lots of evidence in front of us to say that because of cyberspace problems, it's very difficult to regulate remote gambling. You know, if you ban it, it will be here. Now, what I want to ask SARS or the Treasury, have you investigated the possibilities, you know, forget about this bill, but have you investigated the tax revenue possibilities? Is there a chance, you know, I'm putting my old finance on, is there a chance if we do this properly? And is there any other examples where they do have remote gambling, where there is a benefit for tax revenue?
Thank you, Honourable
Cornwall.
Right. Let's go back to yourself then, and that is both the DG, the Flamonia, and also yourself, Mr. Thomasek.
Just to start off with William Lewis's questions, I will certainly look into the matter of letters written to the Minister. I'm not, as I speak to you, aware of them. It may be useful if you can just let me have the details of the letters you wrote and on what date. We have a good system in the Treasury, so I will be able to trace them. We generally do reply, so I'm surprised that there's been no reply, if that's indeed the case. Just with regard to, and you've talked about the physical infrastructure, and France can comment on some of those points. Just with regard to the consultations with the GTI. Look, there's been ongoing discussions on this matter over a long period, okay? But certainly recently, I think we haven't, certainly not with me, may have been meetings with others, so I would have to check on that. But as I said, over the years, there's been lots of discussions and consultations on these. But more recently, I've not been involved in any discussion
on remote gambling. And I said we withheld the bill because the commission went had its own process. And as I when I opened up, I mean, I don't think for us the issue, I think this is a difficult area, whether you prohibit or whether you regulate, because there will always be players who are who assume it if you allow it, who will also not want to register. So how do you deal with that, I think, is a challenge that you need to look at. That's why I made the point. It's not very different from marijuana or whatever. How do you best deal with it, and what's our enforcement capacity? I have no doubt that we can improve our enforcement capacity to the extent that perhaps it's not been an area that's been prioritized. I don't, as I speak to you, have information on how much we can check some of the spending. So if the DTI has met with the South, they don't have to ask us permission to meet with the South. So I think they or the South can comment on any consultations. But having gone into the interactive bill over the years, you know, we do have, I know, some information to the South. Obviously, part of it is cross-border, okay? If it's within the country, I'm not sure how much information South would have. But again, we do have sophisticated systems through the banking system where if you want to mine the data, you can certainly try and get info. But as I indicated in the opening bit, that sometimes it's not obvious a payment is for gambling in particular. If it's to a gambling institution, you might assume that. But if it's to a hotel group in, I don't know, Mauritius or wherever else, how do you know it was for gambling? The systems may find it difficult to determine that. So, nothing is perfect, but it also doesn't mean that there will be no info. Our ability then to stop payments is one issue, but our ability then to take action if there were payments that were clearly, what if we had a law to say it's not allowed, that's another challenge that we'd have to look at. And typically in these things, you know, I don't think anything is totally possible. It's not to say that it would be effective if we put it in the very effective as we would like if we put it in place. But it does mean putting up the infrastructure to deal with it. Having said that, we are living in a world of digital commerce, and I think these systems should be developed not only because of gambling, but for other reasons. So I don't think it's necessarily a cost. In terms of benefits, I mean, I think in these issues, one needs to look at the benefits and the cost. Obviously, if there's any activity that takes place, and there's an income, incidentally, Uncle Williams, even if it's illegal, you still have to pay your taxes, okay? So you have tax confidentiality, but funds can answer those questions, okay? So people still have to pay taxes, even on ill-gotten gains. And then if you find out what ill-gotten gains, even that's taken away, so they may end up paying much more than they actually receive, and that's a big threat that you have over such issues. So there would certainly be benefits from the tax revenue issue. But of course, we would not look at this narrowly just as how much money would come in, because we believe there are costs to society on gambling, and the cost needs to be taken into account. And if it's remote gambling, there are other costs as well, because it certainly deals with flows that go outside, and not for anything that's really productive. One needs to obviously look at both, but I'd like to almost say we leave it to this committee and the DTI to lead us, since the policy really does need to come from them on the score.
Thanks. Just one question, as one of the mentions. SARS is neutral as to whether your income is from legal or illegal sources. We would wish to tax either and both, if you happen to have both. So from that perspective, I would also point out that it's not necessarily so that whatever these providers have provided to a local resident was a gambling service. It may well have been something else that was provided, because some of these people would also have other services that they offer that are not per se gambling, that would be sort of more around entertainment and leisure activities. So that is always a challenge. The three were the ones we were able to track down that we were comfortable were involved in gambling. How would you enforce that someone stays local? Well, this gets us back to the problem of whether you regulate or ban completely, because to take the example offered, so the equipment is all in South Africa, the software is in South Africa, the business premises are here, and you know, the day after getting the license they move offshore, well now they're operating illegally, their license should be forfeit, but how do you stop that happening? So you have very similar challenges leasing the boundaries in either circumstance.
I should have recognised yourself as the gift of son from the Parliament's legal advice unit, and seeing as you've now been attached to us directly to assist, thank you very much. The DDG here, our CCRD, Ms. Zodwe Ntuli, is also here with us. I think she's been at the facility committee, etc. Just got your hand up there on the loose, because I thought once you've been through this round of questions, you may be able to just address this issue. I was looking in your own legislation here, the remote gambling bill, and I don't recall that it was a requirement of the equipment or machinery being located under the South African government jurisdiction. But perhaps you could correct that quite easily and let us know. And then you could also indicate your reason for that as well. So thank you. We've got the Honourable Hill Lewis hand. Anyone else? No one else? I'm looking around me. Right, Honourable Hill Lewis.
Thank you very much. The bill, just to answer your question first, Jefferson, the bill says that the business premises must be located in South Africa. As I said in my previous question, the intention of the bill is very much that the operator applies for a license, pays tax, locates their business, locates their machinery, and whatever else included in South Africa. And as the gentleman rightly says, that license condition must be properly enforced to ensure that those machinery and infrastructure remain in South Africa for the duration of their license period. Again, if there's any suggestion on specific language on how that can be amended to make that absolutely clear from other legislation, then I'd be very, very happy to receive that. To the DG, I will certainly send you the dates and of the correspondence to the Minister's office. I would just say one further point on the gentleman from SARS. I agree with the point that it is difficult. Enforcing regulation is always difficult, not only in gambling. It requires effort and most importantly, it requires resources. Every regulation that anyone can think of is enforceable with an infinite allocation of resources. So the point that I repeatedly try to make in this debate is that the question is not about difficulty in regulation. The question is about the resource position of the South African government. Now, the DD makes the point, and I made the point in my previous question, that the status quo is that online gambling is already illegal, but it is not enforced in South Africa. And there's no mechanism by which the government is able to raise any revenue there's no cost recovery mechanism. There's no mechanism by which the government is able to raise revenue to enforce the legislation. So it is a pure, in the sense, it's a pure cost on the fiscus without any mechanism of recovering that cost. And for me, the great benefits of regulation as opposed to prohibition is that it allows for the far stricter enforcement regulation, because it also provides a mechanism to raise revenue. And so many people have misinterpreted that as, well, it's just about raising revenue. No, it's not about raising revenue. It's not about making a profit of the industry. It's about raising the revenue necessary to conduct enforcement that you desire. And I think that's an important thing to remember in the debate. I wanted to make one final point about the fact that it may be possible to hear, I believe that you share this, and to hear from the DGI before this meeting adjourns. But what seems to be the case from what the DG has said is that he's not aware of any consultation that has taken place in recently with regards to the DGI's proposed policy, and moreover that there's no real understanding of the cost implications and technical infrastructure implications of trying to enforce the proposal. Those two things are concerning to me. Genuinely, I think when we present policy or even respond to the bill that's presented, we should be able to do so on the basis of having a thorough understanding of what the cost and enforcement implications are of the government. And it doesn't seem that work has been done by the DGI, or if it does, or if it has been done, the DG is just not aware of it. So I'll make that point, and I think it would be important to get a response from the DGI on that.
Just point out, I'm not the DG. So.
But what I did want to, I just want this very clear. I think the Treasury has pointed out that it would be preferable in this kind of activity, as an understood thing for certainly tax purposes and the like, to have not only the business located in the country, but also the equipment, the machinery. Now, well, I didn't quite see this here. And I know you, in fact, you used very diplomatic language just now. You spoke about it being implicit.
Mm.
You know, now, where does it say in black and white here in your legislation?
Perhaps you engaged in something else, Jefferson, but I said twice now that if they had any language which makes it absolutely explicit from another piece of legislation that they offer, I'm very happy to accept that. But the intention of my bill is that everything from A to Z be located, including tax, in South Africa.
Yes,
so
that's what I'm saying, but it's not here.
Yes, but
that's your intention.
I've now made the point twice, yes. No, so that's the intention of the bill, and if anyone, yourself included, all the gentlemen, have language which makes that explicit, I'm very happy to accept that. So that is the intention.
Right. Now, that was one question I had as a cheer coming out of our engagements. The other, which seemed to arise from members' engagement previously, and I want to put it through again, is one had been led to believe that it's impossible to control money going out of the country. And that's just a pipe dream. It's totally impossible. You cannot control it as National Treasury, and neither can the Reserve Bank. I thought if that was the case, and when things weren't doing so well, we'd have no money left. So exactly how do you prevent anyone doing as they please with their money? I can just hand out what I've been last, I believe, up to $1 million, $2 million, just hand it out. And yet when I try to send out 10,000, I have a problem. Can you tell me how I send out 2 million, 1 million and the like?
Yeah, obviously there are exchange control limits. Okay, so firstly, it's got it for individuals, for example. For businesses, it goes differently. If there are limits. The staff can physically stop you if you exceed those limits, but it also depends on the mechanism. So, for example, if you look at your credit card and you buy a book on Amazon.com, your credit card will allow it. Okay. Obviously, it's a big amount beyond, it's not that you lose spend. The limit currently is, I think, 4 million. You require tax compliance certificate, etc. If you travel, you have a travel allowance. But most of these amounts are probably small amounts. So, those amounts to your credit card, for example, is easy to do. Okay, so those are the payments, and they all add up over time. I think it's different from taking and transferring a large amount in one go. So there are mechanisms to deal with it and to record it and to take action post the event. Such transactions can continue. And I'm raising this issue also during this process as the issue has come up to ban or not to ban, you know, to do this or not to do the next thing. And as you engage on each issue and you study and examine it, you say, well, is this feasible? Is it actually feasible? Yes, what do you do about it? How do you regulate it, if you allow, and so on? And I think that's really coming from here. We do have, it certainly appears to be, there are a couple of opposing views on the policy per se, whether to have it or not, policy position. But then there are very real other issues that people are raising. Well, even if we go that route, how do we manage and regulate it? I think this is what we're trying to unpack. And we just didn't have your expertise to do so. Notwithstanding we have tried that, you know, draft that legislation or agree to it. But let me take the Honourable Williams.
Thanks, Chair. I just want to talk about money laundering. You said that that was one of the problems with gambling, legal gambling at the moment. I'd like to know what is the implications of remote gambling and money laundering, how the two would work. I mean, at the moment, remote gambling is illegal, so I'm assuming that money laundering that is illegal is taking place anyway through this remote gambling. Do you have any information about that? Do you know if that's happening? You know, how will it be different, remote gambling, to normal legal gambling with regard to money laundering? Thank you.
Over to yourselves then, Mr. Mamonia, Thomasy.
I think just to start off, as I was saying that, and Chair, just to remember your limits, when you, even from your own credit card when you pay, your credit card will have a limit. So even your own bank will not exceed that limit for the day. So if the limit is 20,000, you're going to have a limit, aside from anything else that the SARB may do. I'm not sure what the SARB does specifically, I'm just providing that.
Yeah.
Just from the problem of remote, is that, you know, I want to give you an example. If you look at the tax side, different countries were not sharing tax information. So people sort of play the tax arbitrage route. Obviously, after the global financial crisis, many of the advanced economies were affected, and if you now look at it, Cozy Law is on a body that focuses on sharing of information. So the sharing of information between countries is very limited, certainly with the financial sector, where I look at the regulatory environment. You have relationships between different regulators, and there are mechanisms for them to provide information. So if you take a bank like Barclays, okay, or EFSA, their home regulator is in the UK, the Bank of England. You have a regulator here like the SARB or EFSA. They will share certain information. They have some agreement. When it comes to gambling, there's almost no ways that I think there's a practice of sharing information. And that's the first problem that you have, that other jurisdictions are not obliged to give that information. Now perhaps the world will change at some point and things will happen. Or perhaps you can use the VAT angle, as France has outlined, because there are tax issues that come. With regard to money laundering, I mean, when I talk to the FIC, I think that the issues of laundering may differ from the different type of debts. Obviously, if you go to a casino with lots of illegal cash and you change your chips and nobody asks you questions, and then you cash it out as if they were winnings, nobody would know. With remote, I guess, if it's electronic, there's a different set of problems that you deal with. If you look at the current bill, some of the problems that you have,
supervisors must have powers and capability to access punter and transaction information held by the operator. If the operator is not here, how do you get that information? Criminal investigators must have powers and capability to access the info and one issue is the documentation and transaction records are in South Africa, we would probably have access to it. But if it's out of the country, it's more difficult. Then there's, I've talked about all kinds of overseas websites and how to deal with that. But if you look at the current provisions, just to be specific, only persons who make available gambling activities falling under Section 3 of the National Gambling Act at the moment are subject to the FIC Act. Given that this bill removes interactive gambling from the National Gambling Act, we fear that, or we have a concern that there's a regulatory gap that's created. Fragmentation of laws seeking to regulate gambling and the gambling industry will result in regulatory gaps. There are issues around definitions. For example, the definition allows for online person-to-person gambling, which poses a higher risk from a money laundering perspective as the likelihood of collusion of funds between players increases. Of course, in South Africa, we have the other difficulty. Will such online gambling fall under provincial regulation, and if so, which province? I think that we just say that there are a lot of questions like these that need to be answered. I don't think it's just specific to this bill. I think it's just in general you're going to have issues like this that we're going to have to address. And I guess it does get to, if you build it, do you have the enforcement capacity? If you regulate, you still need enforcement capacity. What capacity do you need? What's better to do? And even if you were to regulate, you may ban certain, you will ban and prohibit certain types of establishments who come in. So conceptually, they're not very different. It's just that the one says zero, the other might bring it to a different percentage, reduce it by 80% perhaps, and some would be illegal. We certainly are not arguing the positives of gambling. I don't think it's particularly productive. I think that we do need a package of measures, not just the law and policy that you have on TTI, but one needs a lot of education about the problems of gambling and some of the risks that people fall in. I mean, if you have remote gambling, how do you decide that the child doesn't actually gamble? I mean, I have such problems even with apps. Your child can go in and download an app because they get to know all your details and how to figure things out, okay? And when you deal with gambling, how do you know the person is over age, for example? If the person is here, the gambler, you can really hold them responsible for taking care right to the end of the chain. But if they're overseas, you're not going to be able to get them. So I don't think we can answer the specific issues. And as I've said, the figures are difficult. And I think just on the issue of consultation, as I've said, personally, I'm not aware of more recent on this particular bill that we've had consultations. But certainly over the years, we've had, we've been talking about the National Gambling Act amendments, we've been talking about the Interactive Bill, we've been talking to each other on the national gambling, the gambling tax that we have in mind. So we have been liaising. I have no doubt that many of our other officials would have been consulted, but there's a number of people who talk to the TTI. I just pointed out that I personally was not on this particular matter, beyond having one telephone check perhaps with the advice issues come in.
is to ask her about the bill. But in terms of the details, we haven't really gotten into the details. I think that's going to be a necessary thing to do.
No, thank you very much, Mr. Mamaniat, on that one. We were just looking at some sort of process to go further on this, and given that I think the number of the case here, that really is going to be three issues we need to look at. One, simply the policy per se. Where does the government of the day want to take this? Purely on the policy matter. Then, having looked at the policy issues, you then faced with an issue of right. We are already regulating gambling. Gambling is legal, it's been regulated. There are some loopholes that in any case require to be amended. But in looking at this bill, it then poses a question very directly, which had been seen simply as an amendment per se, and that is the remote gambling bill. You're looking at taking that interactive gambling, which was there to some extent but not taken through, the committee opposed it in the previous term, and now very specifically a bill that will address such a matter. It's very well crafted, I may add, and it's always useful to get a bill such of that nature because it's all laid out here and you can then begin to unpack and say what is missing. If your policy says that's a green light, let's pursue it. So you come back to the issue of policy, you see, and that is why I did say, and with everyone's agreement, that look here, we've got policy on the table. Let's get grips with that first. I'm glad to hear the EDG because now that policy which you did get brief us on the draft about gambling now, exactly when is this likely to come to fruition? I mean, it's got to stay out there for so long, but what are you talking about? Because we can't delay bills that are on the table indefinitely.
Chair, thank you very much and good morning to all our members. Chair, the draft policies are for public comments for now. We do expect that by end of July we would have all comments that are necessary. Then we do our analysis and then in August, any time towards the end of August, we could come, you know, with a final version after consultation. So there is a timeline, Chair, but I think I did indicate to this committee that it still needs to go to the policy council because that's the process. And so we will try and ensure that council sits in August. But if it doesn't sit in August, we cannot be able to come through with any final version at that point. But we will keep trying our best.
Thank you very much. It's not unusual for us to keep a bill on the table for more than 6 months when we started it, as we did with the Intellectual Property Laws, Companies Act, and also Interactive. But what I'm not prepared to do is to delay a bill that's been tabled, which we opened up recently, and delay that for a year. And that we're not prepared to do. Because it's really not good government to do that. But I think it was considered that, you know, even within our current legislation, there are policy areas that needed to be addressed and loopholes within the legislation. I think that is acknowledged. And I think members do, from what I've heard in the engagement, they accept that the world is changing, but how do we deal with this and still, what is our policy? In what manner does policy drive this? And of course, policy should always drive legislation. I think nobody disagrees on that particular point. So what I'm going to do, especially as we also have liquor on the table, not literally, but to be
if the draft is called liquor and gambling, we are running them simultaneously because the process is the same and the issues that we need to address are aligned.
And quite ironically, I mean, let's be quite honest, where there's gambling, there's liquor. I haven't yet to find gambling place where there's no liquor, even in the proponents. There we are. yeah, so it does make sense. But we have had a look at that liquor policy draft, and I'm just saying this because Honourable McPherson, you were hoping to get another shot at this and so on. I think everyone regards liquor policy as very serious, including the Minister of Social Government, who takes this matter very, very seriously. Basic education, and of course also correctional services, justice and the like. But now, how do we manage the two processes? This is what I'm looking at. We have your agreement, haven't we, Honourable Hill Lewis, that we will tackle our gambling policy first. We've done that, but I've also given you a proviso that, no, we won't just let this go fast. No, I'm adamant about that. On the liquor, it seems that the extension would take us anyway till the end of July, by the sound of it, orders, before you even get it back. That's what I see it. And you know what's worrying me about Maine on the mechanism, I have seen that hand, is that, you know, to discuss something prematurely, we've had an initial discussion, we had one. But now we have another premature discussion, we may find ourselves in a political incubator. So, I just think, those views, Chair, is what the table is for. Got to look at gambling to come first. So, what I would like to do is just to consider this a little bit in terms of the timetable we've got, the program we are facing, and then to try and give some sort of priority to what is already on the table. Do you follow? So let me hear what you have to say, Honourable McPherson.
Thank you, Chairperson. Excuse me. I think if we all agree that in order to have good legislation, we need good policies. Mm-hmm. And that is why I think that it's vitally important from the get-go on what this liquor policy is and what it's going to look like. Now, you know my concerns with what the department brought to us. I didn't think it was sufficient. I think that there was a lot left to hang in the air. There was no evidence put on the table. There was no research put on the table. And 3 to 5 minutes, whatever you want to call it, was just simply not sufficient to engage with the department on what is a largely cross-cutting policy across society. Secondly, I think that we also have to agree that in order to formulate a policy, we need to hear both sides of the argument. We need to hear what the department is advocating for and what industry and civil society also believe should be in that policy. Because at the end of the day, as honourable members, we need to make submissions into this policy as much as all of the other stakeholders should be doing as well. And in order to make that informed submission, we need to hear from everyone and we need to see the research, we need to see the evidence that backs up some very strong proposals that are made by the department. So it's on that basis that that I have said to you in writing that if we could possibly have further engagement with the department and with industry on this matter, I think that the select committee does need to be involved as well. And whether we do it as a one-day colloquium or whatever, but I think that it is so important that we get this right. I think that the deadline for the submissions, the new one now, is the 13th of August, so that does give us sufficient time when we come back from recess to actually look at this in a very comprehensive manner. Thank you.
Yeah, may I just say, I did get a copy of your letter, and the Minister had made it clearly informally, but now more officially, that the request, he had already received a request from industry, and that what had come from the committee, you yourself had written a letter, it simply was in line with the request he had from industry as well, felt it was insufficient time. So that was already extended. Now, it will not be our approach to have our own public hearings, if I can call it, and while, of course, the department is undertaking that process. But I think, you know, it probably only returns to the committee in September, October. I'm just looking at the programming side of things. You know, how long it takes to the policy council first. It then comes to us. Because when it comes to us, Honourable McPherson, they have to let it go, literally. No longer lets you follow. It becomes Parliament's document, Parliament. So I think they want to touch all their bases. When they touch all their bases, as it were, it'll come here, that's it, and it'll go to our policy council. Is that correct, or is it Mr. Nyaki Genzi?
No, no,
they
no, after all the conversation with the public and the council, and probably with the, in passing with Parliament, we cook everything, we go back to Cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
Cabinet adopts this, it is the policy of government. Mm-hmm. And then after that, they say, no, it's okay, take it to Parliament to come with the legislation. But policy is pronounced, yes, behind the scenes, yes.
Yeah, but unlikely to be here before September, you know, according to how I see these processes moving. But let's discuss that over tea or something, because not, you know, detail now. So I don't want to go on back on the liquor, because I also want to release National Treasury. So what we're going to do, Honourable Matt Pearson, we're going to wait for them to complete their process on the policy, the liquor policy, all right? Then with respect to the gambling policy, that, of course, has been expedited. Now, are you talking on gambling policy, Honourable, I mean, DDB?
Chair, no, it's just on the liquor. I just wanted to say that for the interest of Honourable Member McPherson, for all of the studies and the research that he requires, because we refer to them, the documents, so we can provide those, we can send those to him in the meantime, because that's what he says wasn't there, but we refer to all of those issues, and we can send them to him in the meantime, up until that time when we come in.
Yes, I think you normally would have done that, at least communicate with one of the secretaries who's dealing with liquor. Right, just submit the lock there and then he makes it available. I want to conclude on this matter, Honourable McPherson.
Chair, I'm disturbed with what I've heard, because I think that what the Chief Director told us is that we must wait for the government to pronounce on this policy and then we must deal with it after the fact. That is not consultation. How are we supposed to make informed submissions to a policy which will then go to the cabinet when we have not had what I believe to be sufficient opportunity to actually deal with the policy proposal in the committee and with industry stakeholders? Because if it is going to be an instance that if I just finish it,
I do want to conclude the gambling here with you, just simply to say that you may well be coming back, someone there, just as we go to the closure office, perhaps on the policy when that comes before us. But I appreciate you coming here this morning. Thank you. Honourable McPherson?
Thank you, Jane. Because if we are, you know, if it's going to be a case of the DDG just sending us documents and me dealing with it on that basis, and not having an opportunity to engage in a public forum with those, then, you know, I mean, I become a glorified, you know, post office for the Voices of South Africa. I mean, we could, you know, all we do is, you know, push, send buttons and respond to each other on the basis of that. We don't actually have an opportunity to publicly debate and engage with one another on these things. So I strongly, strongly urge you again, Chairperson, that as a committee, I think that we are all in agreement that we are all, you know, deeply interested in this particular policy. And in order for us to sufficiently, as honourable members, make submissions into this policy before it goes to the cabinet and before it then becomes into a bill, that we are sufficiently equipped and empowered to do so
by being able to interact with the department in a public forum and industry stakeholders and NGOs and everyone that wants to do so, so that we can actually better understand where we are going with this policy before it goes to the cabinet. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable McPherson. Ms. Carson, as our legal advisor here from the Parliamentary Legal Unit, can you please comment on the process that we have adopted?
Madam Chair, I think the process, as you set out, is constitutional, because if one looks at Section 85 of our Constitution, the development and implementation of national policy falls within the domain of the executive. And as our colleague over there set out, it's only once that policy becomes approved by Cabinet and it is transformed into legislation does it then fall within the domain of Parliament in terms of Section 44. Also, if we look at the obligation on Parliament in respect of facilitating public involvement, the obligation is on facilitating public involvement in the legislative processes of the Assembly or the Committee.
Right. I thought that may help us all just to jog our memories on the constitutional process there. So, of course, the liquor legislation is really very important in our country. As I said, there are a number of ministries, departments, institutions involved in that, and all of a calling for fresh policy, all of them. So yes, it's a very serious matter, Honourable McPherson, and we will pursue it very strongly, but what you do have, just to remind you, as an individual in your own right, but also as an individual member of Parliament, you may attend those hearings, and you may yourself make comments. So there's nothing to prevent that when it's out there in the public domain. We can never forget we are also members of the public, but also being MPs as well. So please feel free to explore all those avenues, and it is a serious matter, and everyone sitting here I think would agree. So that's the policy approach that we've got. With respect to the gambling bill in front of us, Honourable Hill Lewis, I have no intention on dragging your bill out beyond the Christmas festivity. So we will certainly concede on that, just as an element of good government. But thank you for your understanding of the process, Honourable Hill Lewis.
I presume Friday's meeting, which is my responsibility, details response to the bill proceed.
Yes, I'm going to come to that program. We have just changed a few things. At one stage, we thought we'd be doing trade and industry, going into that on the 22nd and 23rd, as some of you are aware, 24th. But it's been a little too soon to get the people that we want to get. We don't just want to get any old person. We don't want to get everyone from government. We want to get academics. We want to get some real serious research here, and we also want to get government. And I think someone like Ambassador Fraser, you know, with his having a couple of books under his belt, etc., and having been ambassador in the World Trade Organization. So we're getting a few of them, and we can't get some of the critical people we want to get. So we are looking at that, and I hope that on the 24th, we'll be able to communicate that will be the sermon. Right. So what we've done here, to look at your program that you had, which some of you may still have an old one, you were meeting on Friday. We've now moved that and shifted that to the 24th of June. You were meeting on the 19th. You were meeting on the 19th, you're not. You were meeting on the 23rd, we're not. And you were meeting on the 24th, which you are, but we are no longer dealing with the quarterly reports, which we require to engage the departments and see what timing is appropriate there. So just so that you're all clear, but that takes you to the constituency. And there are three things that have come up this term that we can't afford to wait for 2016. Now, I'm not taking the decision now, but I'm just alerting you. One of them was on the horse racing, but there it is. It's part of gambling. Do you see what I mean? So haven't forgotten about that. So those of you who thought we haven't. It is part of gambling. And we will engage on that particular front. The other issue is that the gambling board itself, I mean, we have someone there at the moment itself, isn't it, Ms. Kongwa? I'm sure she's Kongwa, but let me just make sure Kongwa, the administrator. But that we've sort of, you see, the DDG of National Treasury Finance was saying, we rely on the gambling board. And we don't have a gambling board. Well, we've got one now in slow year, and on track. But I'm saying, Ms. Conway, I'm sure you want with a lot of got a team together and that kind of thing. So we're still needing to sort that out as well, and I suppose the department is processing measures in that particular regard. Because that one, and what's happened to the one in KZN, I'm sure Uncle McPherson, you're keeping an eye on that one. Well, there we are. We want all of these provincial gambling boards. We want them more tightly managed under national. And we said we need to review the legislation accordingly. So, our advocate here, the advocate Catherine, one of the jobs I'm now going to give you, and you know, you've got a lot of time when we're away. I would very much like you to look it up at the constitutional issues around the concurrency, the norms and standards, and the manner in which the provincial board flouts everything. And that's all you can call it. We seem to have got, you know, we're not perhaps reading our constitution correctly in this regard, because that would never be the intention of the constitution, that lawmakers make laws and they break them. No, no. So I want that done, and as soon as possible, maybe after 3-4 weeks, you let me have a drop. More than enough time, am I right? Thank you very much. And you, and that'll cover issues like the liquor, and all the concurrent issues. Thank you. I'm closing off, Honourable McPherson.
Just out of interest, in KZN, the legislature is dealing with the KZN gambling bill, which I find interesting considering that the gambling policy has not been finalised, as also the national gambling legislation. But they are still going ahead with a gambling bill that, as far as I can tell, is quite potentially in conflict with the proposed gambling policy. Yeah.
Yeah, well, as I am on good speaking terms with MEC Belinda Scott, she has kept me abreast of those issues, and I didn't see any conflict of interest. In fact, I'm rather pleased that she's having a shot at that, considering the way her gambling board's been behaving. Probably having to bring them into line fast. Thank you. Right. With respect to the committee, we are going to adjourn until the 24th. Please be ready to get the minutes out of the way. Thank you.
Hello. I'm here to get a rest. 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 Get a rest.